Welcome to Mormon Expression Voices. My name is Katrine, and today we have with us a married couple. Her name is Jessica, and her husband is Mark. They have been married for 2.5 years and have 8 children between the two of them, and I'm excited to talk to them. I do want to give a little warning that in this podcast today, there will be a little discussion of rape and spousal abuse. So if this is a trigger point for you, or if you're not comfortable with this topic, feel free to skip it and we'll see you next week, or go back and you can listen to our archives as well. But thank you so much, Jessica and Mark. I'll let you two just begin with your story.
Thanks. We're happy to be here.
We are.
We're going to talk about Jessica's story today because my story is not interesting to anybody. But Jessica has some wonderful stories that we'd
like. I don't think that's true, though. You just think that.
Well, that's true. Okay. Well, why don't we start? Why don't you talk about where you were born and where you grew up, and kind of describe your early childhood?
I was born in Utah, Provo. My parents were not LDS when they had me, but soon after did. I think I was sealed to them when I was 2, possibly.
What was your dad doing at that time?
Oh, my dad was kind of a rock star. He's a musician. He was living in L.A. when I was born, actually, and my mom was here with me, and I was mostly taken care of by my grandma, and he had a record contract in California, but anyway, he decided that it was... He kind of had a freak out moment and decided that it wasn't where he wanted to be and came back to Utah and told my mom we're going to the temple. And she had never been Mormon before. It was a shock. But so I don't remember all this. It's just part of the story they tell me all the time, that he decided to come back to Utah and be Mormon, be a dad.
What did he do to change his life at that time?
Oh, he went to church. He started going to church, went to the temple, took my mom to the temple. Well, I'm probably not going to tell the story right. I feel he did go in and out of believing in the church and then not believing it for a little while, or had some issues with it. And I guess I played with John Singer's kids, and my mom was freaked out because it was like a polygamous thing. And he sold her Porsche and came home with a dune buggy and some machine guns, and we were headed to Canada because the end of the world was coming or something. But luckily, they had a change of heart on the way to Canada and came back. So then they mellowed out about that. I know. There's so many. I have so many lives. It's really scary.
So the fundamentalist part was short-lived?
It was short-lived. And my mom, I believe, was even pregnant at the time with my younger sister. And so, anyway, she didn't want to do it and kind of went along with it. But they came back. So luckily, I was not raised in Canada in the mountains with machine guns and polygamy. But I do come from polygamous. I come from, I'm a very strong LDS background. As far as my extended family, my grandparents on both sides, just that my mom's dad was not Mormon, so she wasn't raised Mormon. But he died before I was born, so I didn't know them anyway.
Why don't you talk about your parents' marriage and what happened with that?
So we had a pretty normal life for quite a few years and lived in Salt Lake. Went to church. My parents had 4 more kids, so there's 5 of us. And I had a little bit of a rocky marriage, like a lot of us. My mom ended up having an affair, and my parents got divorced. I was about 11 at that point.
So your parents got divorced, and then talk about what happened in church.
Well, how old were you when you were divorced?
So
when they were divorced?
I was about 11.
Okay.
Yeah. And I knew that my mom had an affair. I knew that they were getting divorced. I was the oldest in my family, obviously. I was a pretty mature little girl. Both my parents told me a lot of things. So I really knew everything that was happening. And
where were you living at that time?
In Orem at this time. Okay. And we were, my grandparents were our neighbors. And so we were in a very kind of well-known, my grandparents had lived there since my dad was in high school. So my mom moved out and my dad stayed in the house, and he decided to keep me with him, and the other kids went and lived with my mom. And I went to church, and they announced in church that my mom had an affair and was excommunicated. And I just remember sitting there like, oh my gosh. And everyone's like looking at us, and I just felt so Well, gross.
Was this in sacrament meeting?
This is in sacrament meeting. So they used to do that, and I didn't know that they did that until that happened. Maybe I probably just didn't pay attention as a kid, but they did. And it was horrible. And I went home and I just cried, and I just felt like, okay, my family's not forever anymore. We are bad, and we, you know, don't, families aren't forever. And oh my gosh, we're just bad people. And, you know, and it's not like I talked to anyone about that. I just kind of felt like that's what we are now, because we don't have a eternal family anymore.
So describe how your parents' lives changed at that time when you were 11. How they diverged.
My mother, she had a really hard time with it. She fell in love with this man and she married him. And that's a whole other story, but she started to drink, and she, over time, just drank every day to deal with her shame and her guilt of what she'd done, and you know, to numb herself out. So she drank, and my dad got married 6 months later, met his wife, and within a few days, literally like near for 5 days, and they got engaged and got married really quick after that.
Wasn't she in the same ward? How did they meet?
They met at a singles dance.
And a 5 day engagement.
Yeah. And it wasn't about love. It was just, you know, we, at least this is what I remember. They told me that they just wanted the same things, and they both, you know, they just wanted to get married, because she was sick of being a single mom. She had a little girl, so I had a new little sister that was like 3, and her dad was gay, and I was excited, actually, at first. I had had a really good relationship with my dad at that time, and loved being home with my dad. I'd been taking care of the kids so much, because my mom had kind of lost it, you know, about a year before she even had the affair, and was gone a lot. And so I needed a break from being the mom, and it was fun to be with my dad, and we were really close. And I didn't realize, though, like literally like the second he got married, I was now a little girl again, not like his friend. And anyway, I don't really need to get into all that.
Okay. So then let's talk more about so you moved back in with your mom pretty soon after that, right?
Yeah. Well, no, I think I lived with them, I want to say, I don't know if it was quite a year or 9 months or I don't know, something like that. I was living with him and my stepmom for a while, and then went and lived with my mom.
And how were things at your mom's house at that point?
They weren't too bad, actually, at first. They were all right. I liked Ken. He was laid back to me and nice. I mean, he was fine. He owned a bike shop, and I started working in the bike shop and being involved with that pretty quick after that. I liked that. We built a house at that time, but we didn't go to church. So we lived in Orem, Utah Valley, if you think about it, and we didn't go to church. And I actually didn't mind it. When I went to live with my mom, I decided I wasn't Mormon anymore. And so I'm like 12-ish, 13-ish at this time, 8th grade, and I just was happy to not be Mormon, actually, just to let it go. And my dad, I had been fighting with my dad so much before I moved out, and he had really turned, I felt, very judgmental and controlling as soon as he got married, and we were fighting about just stupid stuff, and I just wanted to have nothing to do with the way that the patriarchy and the control. And so it was kind of a relief, actually, to not be Mormon. My younger brothers and sisters had a harder time. Some of them went to church, but I was fine not going to church. But I had friends that weren't Mormon, and I thought life was fine as far as the church goes.
So do you want to talk about Las Vegas?
So 15, my mother and a couple of her girlfriends took me and my best friend to Las Vegas. And I can't remember I think this was the second time we had gone with her. We laid out at the pool, stayed at the Hilton, flirted with the lifeguards, met these older guys. They were 23, and they invited us to go to a party that night.
The lifeguards?
The lifeguards from the hotel we were staying at. So we did, and we went to some party somewhere in Las Vegas, and it was just a lot of, I don't know if they were college, I don't know, but it was kind of like college age people or something. So we felt very mature, and we drank beer, played quarters with them, and the guy ended up taking me to a golf course and he raped me.
What did you do after that happened that night?
Well, I hadn't even kissed a guy, first of all, at this point. My friends had, everyone had. I was like the only one of my friends that hadn't made out before. I was kind of out of my mind, emotional. We had a couple of friends, these older guys that from Orem High that were staying at another hotel, and we called them, and we went to their hotel room, and I just ran in their room, and I ran into the bathroom, and I turned on the shower, fully dressed, and showered. Just stood there under the shower, bawling. I feel like I was screaming. I don't know. I don't really remember the whole thing, but I know that I was in the bathtub in my clothes for a long time before my friends came in and said, "We need to get you out of here. Should we call your mom?" And I was like, "No way, no way. We're not telling anyone about this. I don't want anyone to ever know about this."
Why not?
Because I felt like it was my fault that I went to a party and I had drank alcohol. I wasn't drunk. I don't remember being drunk. For sure, I remember everything about it. It wasn't like I was like drunk in that way, but I had drank. And the most memorable thing was the next day walking around the mall with my friend. And I had a friend at that time that had had sex with a couple of people. And I remember looking at her like she was a slut. Like, not really understanding, but, oh my gosh, you know, I hadn't even kissed a boy, and she's having sex. And I just walked around and was like, I'm not going to say her name, but I'm her. I was like, I'm her. That's who I am now. I'm her. And I didn't want anyone to know that. You know, I didn't tell anyone that. And I cried a lot, and I don't know, I just wanted to forget it. Just wanted to forget it.
Did you ever seek medical help or?
No,
or?
Absolutely not.
And you never told your mom?
It took me until I was about 18 and I had gone to counseling. And I told the counselor and she told me I needed to tell my mom. So I believe that's when I told my mom. I can't remember for sure, but I'm pretty sure I didn't tell her till about then, about 18.
How did that affect your mom?
I don't really know. It's not something we talked a lot about. We might have talked about it, but I don't know. I'm sure she felt really guilty and really bad. She would feel bad about it now. She is such a good person. She's such a beautiful person. She was an alcoholic at that time, and she had her own problems. And I looked at her like a teenager, and like I was more the mom. So I didn't feel like I had anyone to tell. I didn't have anyone to tell.
How's your mom's life now? How's that changed, just generally?
Oh, she's very religious, but, you know, in her own way.
But she's not an alcoholic.
But she's not an alcoholic, no. She actually went to church in order to stop drinking. She didn't go to, like, you know, AA or anything like that. It was Jesus.
The Mormon Church?
Mm-hmm.
Let's talk about how... After that happened when you were 15, how did that affect your life?
Well, this was literally a month before I started high school. And I don't really know exactly how it affected me or if I would have been different. It's hard to say. I was pretty good at just pretending like I was fine. I had been doing that for a while with my family, stuff that had been going on in my home. So I started high school. I actually had a lot of fun. I was a good kid. I got good grades. I dated lots of guys, but I did start to make out and drink, and not because I felt like I was sinning, though. I didn't feel bad about it. I didn't feel bad like I was doing something wrong. I just did. That just was part of life.
Were a lot of people sexually active at Orem High?
Oh, yes. Everyone in my group was. Everybody You know, I started as a sophomore, and I immediately became friends with the senior boys, dated some senior boys. I didn't have sex with my first boyfriend, but I did with my second boyfriend that ended up being my boyfriend for like 3 years. But all of my friends, everybody, like, and they were all, most of them were Mormon. My boyfriend was not Mormon. My best friend was not Mormon. But pretty much everybody else in our group was, and everybody was. So it wasn't weird to me.
So let's skip ahead a little bit and talk about, you graduated from high school, you moved to Salt Lake at some point, or moved to Park City and then Salt Lake, or what?
Well, I went to Arizona first and lived with my boyfriend. Do you remember that?
Oh, yeah.
So I didn't go my senior year. I decided to, I could graduate early. I only had like two classes. So I went to UVCC back then, lived with my friends in the dorms, and then moved out to Arizona with my boyfriend. He was going to ASU. So my mom literally drove me out there and took me to my boyfriend's house to live with his dad and his 23-year-old girlfriend.
How old were you at the time?
17. So I turned 18 in Arizona living with my boyfriend. But I like went to bars with my mom at 17. You know, I had a fake ID, and it just, like, my life was just so different than the average person around here.
So was your mom like the cool mom, or were people judging you?
No, my mom was like a cool mom.
Cool mom?
She was the mom.
She was the hot mom.
She was the hot mom. She dressed very cleavage revealing and, you know, spandex, the 80s. And everyone liked her. I liked her. There was things I didn't like about that, but there were lots of things that I did. I think that, you know, I think it made me a more responsible person in a lot of ways, I just had to take care of myself because she was like a teenager raising us for a while there. So yeah, went to Arizona, started hair school out there, and I had known I'd want to be a hairdresser for a long time. College was never talked about in my house. Nobody ever talked to me about going to college. No one talked to me. You know, my dad at this point, who was in the bishopric, had really nothing to do with any of us, and really abandoned us in a lot of ways because we were being pretty neglected at home with my dad. Well, very neglected, I should say.
You mean with your mom?
My mom and her husband, there was a lot of neglect, let's say, and just weird stuff that we don't have to get into. But
did your dad know that?
Yes, yeah, absolutely. My dad knew that. He knew that. He was in the bishopric. I was fighting with him constantly, begging him, trying to get him to save my siblings, help them, you know, get involved. And it just, you know, we're still fighting about it to this day. But so I, at that point, thought Mormonism, I don't want to have anything to do with it. He was not. I didn't see a good example of Mormonism at that point. I didn't see a good example with my mom either, but at least she didn't ever leave us. She didn't like abandon us and choose, you know, the new wife. That's the way I saw it. I'm sure he would say it's something different, but that's the way I see it. I guess I should say something that we didn't talk about that was a big deal to me was that my dad wasn't there. That I've dealt with in therapy a lot about this rape is that my dad was not protective of me, and I couldn't tell him, but that's what I wanted and that's what I needed. I really wanted my dad to protect me, and I wanted to tell him about it, but I couldn't. I knew that he would just look at it like it was my fault, and I was the cake that had been bitten out of, or, you know, eaten, the chewed up gum. I mean, I did hear those stories. I did come from that mindset, even though I wasn't going to church. I knew his mindset in the church. And so that was, I think, the most painful thing about the whole situation, if I look back on it now and how it affected me, is that I just couldn't trust men in general.
You weren't being protected.
Wasn't being protected. And I couldn't trust. I mean, where's God? And where are men? Men don't do anything but hurt you. Or leave you.
So, do you want to talk about next? You moved around after Parks. You went after Arizona. You moved back.
Came back and lived with some fun friends in Provo for a little bit. Got a job at Nordstrom. Went to Salt Lake. Lived with my college friend. You know, kind of the college you people. Eventually, I got a job in Park City and lived up. Then I moved up there, worked, managed a salon, and also worked as a hostess at the Stein Erickson Lodge. That was fun. Went to bars once a week, but I had two full-time jobs. I was working my butt off just to take care of myself because there was no one that was going to take care of me. I didn't have health insurance or I had to buy my own car and pay for everything. So, and I like nice things and I like a good life. So I just worked really hard. Just took care of myself.
How old were you by this point?
So I was in Park City from 19 to 21. And then right before, I actually had been wanted to move out of state really bad. And I started thinking about, I want to move out of state. And I had an opportunity where I met a woman that was my boss's friend from LA. And she was this really dynamic woman. And she had just started a new antique design store in Beverly Hills. And so she met me and my boss told her I wanted to move. And she's like, come help me start this company. And so I literally 2 weeks later was car packed up driving to LA to go do this. And that was fun. It was a fun experience. I learned a lot.
Why did you leave? Why did you leave LA? It was about a year that you were there.
The crazy thing is I'm not the best picker of guys, of men.
Sorry, Mark.
So far,
no.
Until she met me.
Until I met Mark. I am not the best picker. And so I worked in Beverly Hills, and I was around lots of money. I mean, we decorated Emmy parties. Everyone that came in our store was a celebrity, all the clients. And I had lots of exposure and opportunity to do lots of things. After about a year, realized that I don't trust myself. I'm going to get in a lot of trouble here. I remember the thing I said in my mind, I'm just a little Utah girl. I think I need to go back, it had nothing to do with a religion or anything like that. I felt like I needed to come home. So I did and finished hair school. As soon as I finished hair school, I moved to Salt Lake. I do not want to live in Utah Valley. I'm really not a Utah Valley girl, even though I am, I guess. A guy that I had dated right before I left for LA, Scott, maybe I shouldn't say the names. I don't know. I didn't ask his permission. I don't think he'll care. But I had dated him before, and he came to see me at the salon where I started working. And it was like, oh my gosh, like, hey. Like, we were like in love the first time we saw each other. So he was immediately my boyfriend pretty quick. And he said to me one day, like, only like, I don't know, a month after dating or something. I'd known him for years. Let's just put it. I mean, I had known him and dated him before, but after about a month of dating, he got all emotional and said, I think we should have a baby. Well, I just came from LA not too, long before that, where like my bosses, like lots of people were having babies. Marriage didn't matter. You just had a baby if you want a baby. I really wanted to be a mom. And just cried and said, okay, let's have a baby. And I didn't. And my mom was on her third marriage at this time. And my dad, I didn't see good marriage. I didn't see marriage as a good thing. I didn't have a good example of that. So I didn't care about getting married. I just wanted to have a baby. And he was really cute and a good athlete and tall. And, I'm pretty short. I was like, we're going to have cute kids. We were just like stupid. We were literally like, we were just stupid, young and stupid. So we hadn't even had sex at that time, but got pregnant probably the first time we did. I don't know. I was pregnant a week or two later. And
how old were you at that time?
I was 23, almost 24. So was pregnant. I really soon after that get so deathly ill that I can't keep any food down, lost a lot of weight, was super sick, had to quit my job. And he was just a guy that just barely got me pregnant, and it wasn't hitting him the same way, like the reality. So he was still going to bars and bringing guys, bringing a bunch of people home to play cards till 4 a.m. and I'm in the next room throwing up. And we were so excited to get pregnant. But after I was pregnant a month or two, well, I think 2 months of pregnancy, I was like, I'm out of here. Thanks for the sperm. You're a sperm donor. Bye. And so I had an aunt at this time. Oh, so crazy. I had an aunt that was very religious and had a lot of money and lived in Bountiful. And so she had been telling me, you can come and live with me, if you want to leave him. I was just being kind of pressured to leave him. And so when things weren't going exactly how I wanted them, I'm like, bye, and left him. And so I went and lived in her one of her apartments in her house. She had a house, this huge house of apartments, and I lived there.
In Bountiful.
And at this time, my mom had just barely started, she'd started going back to church at the same time. And
is this your mom's sister?
My mom's sister, her only sister. And so my mom and her husband, who were the last people you would ever think would ever go to church, were going to church. And I had just, here I'm pregnant and single now, and, you know, I'm sad because I really loved Scott, but just, you know, wasn't going as I wanted it to go. So my mom started saying, I think you should go to church. Why don't you start to pray? Why don't you go to church? And there were several people in my life that I had seen, you know, have these miraculous kind of like changes because they went to church. So I was like, okay, well, I'll try that. So I started going to the singles ward in Bountiful, pregnant.
Which has probably never been done in the history of Bountiful.
I just wish I could see the expressions when you walked in.
How far, you were obvious.
No, I was pregnant. Oh yeah.
And
I looked pregnant.
At the singles ward.
Yeah. But I really was naive too that was weird. Like, it was like, well, my aunt even said, like, why don't you go to the singles ward? And I'm like, okay, you know, like, I got some dates there. I did. I mean, I did, and they were even like, I'll be the, I mean, whatever, it was so weird. But the crazy story about it is, I mean, that's crazy in itself, right? But, so, as soon as I go to the ward, I'm called in by the bishop. Now, I have not been to church since I'm like 11, right? I mean, I don't have the mindset of Mormonism or church, or like, I didn't think was doing something wrong. I chose to get pregnant, and I was graduated from hair school, and yeah, I didn't have money at that time, but I had full confidence that I can take care of this baby on my own. I wasn't worried about it. So this bishop, who was a very kind of a wealthy, well-known guy up in that area, calls me in and proceeds to tell me that I need to think about adoption. And he handed me some pamphlets from, like, adoption pamphlets from the church. And I was so pissed. I'm like, what are you talking about? Like, I'm not giving this. I wanted to have this baby. Like, I'm excited to have this baby. Why would you talk to me about that? Well, this is, you know, what we're supposed to do. And this is what we need to talk about this. We need to talk about this. I'm like, no, I don't need to talk about this. I'm not.
Was he trying to push you to get the baby up for adoption?
He wanted to have a talk with me about that.
Had he ever talked to you about your situation before that meeting?
No. It's not like I knew him that well. It was like calling me in and, you know, we need to talk about adoption. And I'm like, what? So then he said, I want to see you every week. I'm like, okay, whatever, you know. So I came in the next week and he said, you know, pulled out the pamphlet again, like literally like puts it on his desk. I'm like, okay, if you ever bring that out again, I'll never come in here. I'll never talk to you again. I'm not giving this baby up for adoption, so there's no need in showing me this. Like, I was pretty upset about it. And he was like, okay, well, that's too bad. Or, I mean, he definitely was thinking that that's what I should do. And then he wanted to do a court of love.
Well, he'd asked you to confess your history, right?
So yeah. Well, in the court of love, though.
Oh. He didn't know? He must have known something about what your history
probably,
was.
Yeah, I mean, I probably told him. I guess I would have answered whatever questions he asked me.
So he convened a bishop's court, a disciplinary council.
Yes. Yeah, that's because I was disfellowshipped.
So tell us a little bit about how do you remember it?
I remember being really scared and really intimidated, and they asked, you know, lots of questions.
How many people were in the room?
I don't know, however many they're supposed to have, I guess.
Four or five men.
Oh yeah, like a bunch of men.
Were you even aware what it really was, the Court of Love?
Well, I knew a little bit about it I probably did know, just because I would have talked to my mom. But my mom was a little, probably in a similar, a little bit naive about things as I was, maybe. I don't know.
When she was excommunicated, did she go through a disciplinary council also?
Yes, yeah. And she was very honest. It's not like she didn't have this long, dragged-out affair. Like, she went and told the bishop as soon as she had sex with him. And I was a very honest person. I wasn't hiding anything or worried about telling him. I just told him. It was...
Did they ask a lot of detail?
Honestly, I don't even remember.
So even though you hadn't even really been to church since you were 11, they still disfellowshipped you.
Mm-hmm. And I was bugged about that for many reasons, just because I did know people, especially men, that had done a lot worse than me and went to church, and that had never happened to. I was bugged about it. But at the same time, I was told that they have the priesthood and the keys to my salvation, and so this was good for me. This would be good for me to work through this disfellowship. You know, I really wasn't like angry about it because I was like an obedient mind at the time. I guess this, as far as like they have the authority, and I just believed it. I didn't like question like what they were doing was wrong because they're in charge and they know what they're doing.
What happened next?
Scott and I ended up getting back together right after Scotty was born, my son. And we got married a month later or so, maybe 2 months later. We got married. I mean, I got married. Ended up with them.
The same guy who was the father of your son.
Yeah. Yeah, we ended up. We ended up getting married. I did tell him, okay, I've decided to be Mormon, and I will, you know, we can get married, and you don't have to be Mormon, because he was not.
Well, but he was a returned missionary.
Yeah, but he wasn't Mormon. And so he just said, okay, you know, you can go to church, and I'll watch football, and, you know, I just said, as long as you support me going to church, then that's fine. So that was the way it started, as far as that went. And so I had moved to Orem by that time, and was going to my mother's ward because, you know, because I went by myself with my baby. So I went to her ward for quite a while until we ended up renting a house in Pleasant Grove for a while. And I never went to that ward. I just went to my mom's ward until we moved to Salt Lake.
And then you had another baby.
And we had another baby. We had a daughter 2 years later. And there was a lot of happiness. There was a lot of, it was hard. I don't really want to tell a lot about that. I don't think that's appropriate for him, just because I respect him as a person. But we had moved to Salt Lake, and after 5 years of marriage and some struggles, we ended up getting divorced. A big part of why I divorced him was because of the church. And my father's advice that I, you know, needed, that Scott was not good enough. He wasn't worthy and wasn't good enough, and divorced him. And we were friends. It was an amicable divorce. We, you know, babysat each other's, you know, his girlfriend's little girl, you know. I mean, we were definitely amicable and friends. I owned a salon at that time. I was actually pretty successful. I had started a big kind of a store/salon and was traveling a lot and super busy. I mean, crazy busy. My kids were now like both in school. So one of my clients at that time had done some work for me on my building, and I had actually worked with him in Park City also. So we had the same kind of thing. Like, I'd known him for years, and he was a client. And so when I got separated, immediately was, you know, he came to see how I was doing, take me to lunch, check in on me, and talk to me a lot about Mormonism, because he had been excommunicated and wanted to get back in the church, is what he said. But he was living with his girlfriend that was not Mormon, and I was actually telling him, you know, well, you need to get married to her, just marry her, or you need to have her move out, because if you're going to be Mormon, you can't be living with your girlfriend, so you got to decide. And I was you know, as a hairdresser, you're kind of a counselor, and so I was just the counselor. He was interested from the get-go, and I was flattered, and I was attracted to him, and we started to date pretty soon. It was kind of a drama there, a little bit. It was a drama. It was always a drama. The biggest thing that has to do with Mormonism with that is that even though there were lots of signs, what would you call it, red flags, that this was not going to be a good relationship. I was maybe going down the wrong path.
But you felt trapped in a way at the same time, or not?
Well, I didn't feel trapped. I was definitely in love. I was very in love. And I was very, he was opposite of my first husband, let's say, you know, he had a job. He had a house. I'm so into houses, and he had this old house, and he was, you know, hiring me to come and help him design it. And he's so romantic and so interested in me and interested in talking to me and knowing me and wanted to know everything about me and thought I was so wonderful. And so, you know, it was like being idolized. And my first husband, he loved me, but that was like a big part of why I divorced him, is because it was hard for me to feel loved. Just a totally different kind of guy. Just, you know, didn't want to talk very much.
But the second guy was that a listener. He liked
wanted
to talk.
Wanted to know everything about me. What started happening a couple years into the relationship, or not even a couple years, there was I didn't trust myself. I didn't listen to the warning signs and the people, my family and friends around me that were saying, oh, I'm not sure you should do this. You know, this is kind of scary. But guys like that, that are predators, they're really good apologizers, the best apologizers. They're really romantic and loving. I had the two extremes. I had so in love with you. I'm so in love with you. We are soulmates. We were meant to be together. And he had been excommunicated, and he was trying to get back in the church. And so my mind was all about that Satan is trying to tempt him into not going back to church and trying to keep us apart because we're meant to be together. We're soulmates, you know, and that's how we talk to each other a lot. You know, we knew each other in heaven. We were meant to be together. Oh, it's so crazy now when I say it, but
at the same time, there were warning signs.
Many warning signs. So the biggest thing that happened, I think, before I married him, we were actually engaged and about to go get married. And he had hit me. And I had actually broken up with him several times throughout the relationship. There was a lot of drama, but he was so good at getting me back. And I knew that I couldn't leave him. I knew that he wouldn't let me go. And I called my mom and her husband at the time, her husband, and asked for a blessing. I need a blessing. I need help getting out of this relationship because I don't think I'm supposed to marry him. And I need help, Mom. And so they came up to my house and
they knew why you asked for the blessing.
Oh yeah, they did. And
did they also see warning signs?
Mm-hmm. Oh yeah. My family actually were all afraid of me marrying him, and my friends. They didn't think I should. But part of them, they could see why I wanted to, why I was in love with him. I mean, it was so hard because there's good and bad. But what happened was at that blessing, he proceeded to tell me that I was the key to his salvation.
This is your stepdad told mm-hmm. you that in
yes,
the blessing.
Yes, in the blessing.
That this guy you were dating was, you were the key to
I
his.
I was the key to his salvation. And I remember crying, and my mom was crying, and we're like hugging, and she's like, I guess you're supposed to marry him, you know, because we just believe the priest did. So the priest is telling me to do. So it's like, okay, I'm strong enough. I'm supposed to be a good example, and if I can just be good, then it's all going to be fine. He's going to get rebaptized, and we're going to, you know, go off into the sunlight, and with, you know, it's all going to be perfect. That's what I believed.
What happened?
Well, got married. And on my honeymoon, he got so jealous. The biggest problem we had was jealousy. And telling me how I just didn't know how to be a wife. I didn't know how to because I was raped. He would use the fact that my dad abandoned me, that I was raped, that my mom was an alcoholic, that I wasn't really raised correctly, because he came from a very Mormon family on the outside, 9 kids, you know, always went to church. And he went on a mission and, you know, all this stuff, but he would use my past and shame me and do character assassination on me if I wasn't doing things that he thought I should do. And I would feel so bad about myself that I was like, you're right, you're right. I just, you know, I believed him. You're right. I don't know how to be. I guess I'm supposed to be jealous of you too and be worried all the time. And
so go back to what happened on the honeymoon.
So he got jealous and we went back to our room and he proceeded to be very scary abusive.
On your wedding night?
Not the wedding night, but probably the next night maybe. And
was he physically abusive as well as verbally?
He was more verbal. Physical would be more like holding me down or pushing me down or something. So some physical, but the verbal was horrible. And so he ended up leaving the room at some point, and I locked the door, and I just was crying and crying uncontrollably, and I actually was calling his mom, I think. I don't know. Maybe I didn't call his mom yet. He was banging on the door, and wanted to come in, and I was scared. Because this was the first time it got that bad. And I was really scared. Well, he literally bashed the door down, like that. Like the Grand Way.
The Grand Way.
And I ran into the bathroom and locked the door. I slept in the bathtub. The next, he propped the door up. The next day, he's a contractor. We went to Home Depot and we bought paint and stuff and he fixed it and no one knew that happened. But I really did think I was going to have to divorce him when I got home. I was like, wow.
On your honeymoon?
Oh yeah, like on my honeymoon, I'm like, oh my gosh. But he really was so good at apologizing, and it's never going to happen again. And the only reason that I did this is because I love you so much and that you're so special to me. I'm just afraid of losing you. And I knew that he his parents had a really hard marriage. And he would, you know, cry to me and tell me how, you know, he's just afraid of marriage and all of that. And so I just would feel bad. And trauma bonds start to be developed. And, you know, anyone that's gone through stuff like this, the trauma bonds are like heroin, truly. They create the same drug in your brain. And so you want to leave, but then you want to stay. And you want to leave, want to stay. You can. And I'm a fixer, and I wanted to fix it. And also, I'd already been married and divorced. And, oh my gosh, I can't do it again. Like, my pride, you know, I was a hairdresser. I had so many clients and people that it would be too embarrassing. And my kids really liked him. He never did anything like that. He didn't do it in front of my kids. So I wanted to make it work. And like I said, I kept telling myself this was just evil trying to break up the good that we have and what we can have. So I didn't leave him.
Let's
got
take
worse.
A quick detour and talk about you met again with the bishop when you moved into a new ward.
Mm-hmm.
Tell me about that.
Did another court of love, another fellowship.
Why don't you tell about a little more detail than that? Do you remember? Why did you meet with the bishop? Did he call you in?
I don't remember. I don't know.
So right after you got back from your honeymoon, you got disfellowshipped again?
I don't know exactly
why,
the timeline.
Why were you disfellowshipped again?
Because we had premarital sex.
Okay.
I mean, I dated him, I think, about a year and a half before, which I was pretty proud of myself, actually. Like,
for dating a year and a half.
So well. You know, but anyway, I was disfellowshipped again. Yeah. And I was bad. I was bad. Sinner. I don't remember that being that big of a deal. And he hadn't been rebaptized, so it wasn't like, you know, I wasn't psycho Mormon. I mean, I hadn't been uber Mormon ever. You know, I was obedient in my mind. Like, I tried to be obedient. I tried to do a good job, but I, you know, made mistakes and I was human and I didn't look down on myself the same way maybe a lot of other people would. I looked down on myself when he told me things about myself, how bad I was. So about a year into the marriage, I actually got really depressed, ended up having to shut down my salon. I got shingles, broke out in shingles all up my back. I knew it was from stress. I cried to him. I said, if I didn't have kids, I would kill myself. I'm so depressed. I felt so bad about myself. Why are you, I can't have you be so mean to me.
So the abuse had been continuing for that year and a half after your wedding.
Mm-hmm. Oh yeah, worse? For sure. I don't know. It was just bad. It was just hard and bad and hard. But I was always trying to think of what I could do. I could read another book, or we'd go to another counselor. He loved to go to counseling. Went to lots of counseling. And I quit my job, shut down my salon. I started a business with him. I thought if we work together and he has control of me and control of my time, then he won't be as jealous. He'll be happier. We'll be happier. It'll all be fine.
So he had a problem with jealousy with the people coming in to your salon. Was that a big problem?
Oh, yeah. Very jealous about that. Would check my books. If there were guys that had, I'd cut their hair, he would question me for hours on end. Hours. We're not talking about someone said a mean comment and walked off. It was keep me up at night, not let me go to sleep, do horrible things to me, and, keep the lights on. I won't get into the details, but pretty horrible things he would do. And we were trying to have a baby. I thought, if he has a baby with me, it's going to be okay. We're going to get him baptized. We got him baptized maybe a year later after we were married. I had so much hope that that was going to change everything.
The baptism?
Mm-hmm.
Did it?
No. Maybe for a time frame. Maybe there would be a month or something of not as bad. But no. And then it was, now we just got to get to the temple. We need to get to the temple. The temple was a big deal to me. We need to get to the temple and get sealed. I wanted my kids sealed to me. I want to be sealed. I need to go to the temple. I wanted that with my first husband, and he didn't want that. And I just thought, I need to go to the temple. Now that was the new goal, to make it all better, just go to the temple.
But you thought having a baby would make it better too.
Yeah.
Talk about that a little bit. How did that go?
So the crazy thing is I did have a miscarriage. And we couldn't get pregnant for 3 years. I believe it was about 3 years. Couldn't get pregnant. I finally got pregnant. I had a miscarriage. When I had the miscarriage, I thought, God's telling me I need to get out. I'm not supposed to have a baby with him. But then I just, no, that's not true. Why would God do that to me? No, God wants me to be married. And then, and mind you, he's apologizing all the time and saying I'm going to do better and going to church. And he's got the priesthood, and he was great and fun in a lot of ways. And there was a good, so it sounds crazy that I would still be in it. But at the same time, there was a lot of good. And I had my heart was in it 100%. And he would beg for my heart, for me to open my heart more and be more vulnerable and tell him more about how I feel. And I would, and then he'd use it against me. So I finally got pregnant, and got worse, which I didn't know. I didn't know about abuse at the time. I had never been hit before. I had never been abused. And I actually remember hearing clients of mine tell me about abusive relationships, and I wouldn't say it to them, but in my mind I'd say, okay, nutbag, just leave. Why would you stay with someone that's like that, And then being in it, it starts slowly. It's the frog in the boiling water. You don't realize how bad it is, really. And there's bad and good and bad and good. And I slowly had given away my soul to him. I had given away, I didn't have access to our money. Nothing was in my name. Everything, I had given over. I felt like if I just trusted him and gave him everything, and he told me this, then he would trust me if I just submitted. I needed to submit to him. I need to stop being such a strong-headed woman and so independent and think I can do things on my own, because I can't. He wanted me to be submissive, and that would show how much I loved him, and then he would feel safe. Of course, it didn't work, but, I'm like, okay, I can do this. That's how women are supposed to be. Proclamation of the family, women are supposed to submit. So women are supposed to let their man be a man and take care of you, and...
Even adopted your children.
We had had drama happening with their dad, and they hadn't been seeing their dad for a while, and we hadn't gotten child support for years. And so I had found out that the only way I could get sealed to my children was if they were adopted by him. And so that's what I needed to do. They needed to be adopted by him. And so we had mentioned that to my ex, and he, of course, was mad at first, but he was facing jail time if he didn't give up because he had so much past debt. So he finally submitted to giving up his rights. But okay, I'll go back. I finally got the courage to go to my bishop and tell my bishop that I was getting hurt physically and emotionally.
Was this while you were pregnant?
So I was pregnant, and that's why I felt I got the strength, because he was hurting me with the baby, and I, I'd read about that babies can feel it and they know it and they hear it, and so I was, I'd beg him, you're hurting the baby too, not just me. And so I finally went and told my bishop, and I'm not faulting him. I think he was doing what he thought was best, but my bishop literally looked at me and just patted me on the leg and said, "We need to get you to the temple."
So wait.
When I told him that I was being abused.
Instead of getting you out of the marriage.
Or help, or whatever you should do, I guess.
Didn't even call the police?
No, absolutely not. No, we need to get you to the temple.
Did you talk to your husband?
Oh yeah, and he didn't deny anything that was happening. He would admit it. He would admit it, and he would just say, "I'm not going to do it anymore." And he would say that. Yeah, he would say he would admit it. He admitted it, and he felt guilty, and he felt bad, and remorseful, and So it was every time we went, and he would be remorseful. I would think, this is the time that he's going to see I've stuck by his side through this. He's going to see I love him, and it's not going to happen anymore. Okay, I guess the bishop holds the keys to me. He holds the keys. He has priesthood power. So he tells me going to the temple is what we're supposed to do. I cried and I didn't want to go yet because I wanted my kids sealed to me when that happened. And I knew, and we didn't have an adoption yet. We hadn't come to that agreement. I knew that that was a possibility at some point, and so let's just wait. And I was pressured by everybody that, this baby needs to be born under the covenant. So that's what needs to happen. And you need to get to the temple as soon as possible. And that's going to fix your marriage. And that's going to help everything. And even though I knew he wasn't worthy under the temple questions, he wasn't worthy. But who am I to judge? I mean, I'm not as judge as the bishop is. So we went to the temple. I was 8 months pregnant, went to the temple. And the things that he said to me in the celestial room, were awesome. They were magical. I thought the whole thing was weird. Honestly, that's a whole nother podcast. But as far as that part of it, I was like, okay, that's why we're on the right path. I went through all this for. I didn't go through all this for nothing, I'm going through all this for a reason, and it's gonna all work out. And so we went. 6 months later, kids were adopted. And of course, that was just a tool of manipulation held over my head from then on out. I will take you to get sealed now, or no, I'm not going to. It was this carrot held in front of my.
So if you didn't do what he wanted you to do, then he would use the temple sealing mm-hmm. to
oh, yeah.
put pressure on you.
Yeah. Yeah. So.
Did the abuse get worse as well?
Yeah.
So the temple didn't make it better?
No. Got a lot worse. And it finally got to the point where I called the police one day. And I had gotten away and gotten into the garage and had backed out of the garage when the police got there. And so I'm sitting out. And okay, mind you, I'm living in a million-dollar home in Federal Heights, a very nice area. Very well to do. I lived.
thought, I'm like the trailer park person living in the middle of all these great people. I was so ashamed. I would never tell anyone. I told everyone how wonderful our life was and how great and how lucky I am. I was so brainwashed into being submissive and loving. And I literally thought that my husband could like hear what I was saying when he wasn't around. I really felt that way. I felt like he would know if I said something against him to somebody. I became like a shell of myself. And I wanted to protect my kids, and I didn't want them to know, or anyone else for that matter. But anyway, I'm sitting in the gutter with the police at my house questioning me, and like this woman comes driving. And my ward comes driving up. She's just such a great woman that I respected. It was so embarrassing, but I finally was crying to her because, you know, I couldn't help it. And I just said, if I leave him, am I not Christ-like? Because he asks for forgiveness when he does this, and I'm supposed to forgive him. I was constantly questioning these things and listening to conference and lessons. And one thing that I wish the church would do now that I'm, you know, standing back from the situation, that there should be, what is it called? That we some of the talks they give should only be for people in healthy relationships. Like a disclaimer. And I remember thinking that because of a book that Dr. Laura, there was a book she wrote for How to Love Your Man, or I don't know, some book that actually was used against me by my ex also. But I read in the beginning when he wanted me to read this book to, you know, fix me so that he won't abuse me, because I need to be fixed so he won't abuse me. And it said, the disclaimer, if you're in an abusive relationship, this is not for you. And that they need to say that, because so many of the talks that they gave made it worse for me, made me submit more, made me love him more. I need to do, you know.
Did any church person ever advise you to get out?
Well, yes, finally. My last bishop that I, after that, after the police incident, I kicked him out of the house. And we started going to counseling. We were sent to counseling at LDS Social Services, where this guy, who was our counselor, did the same thing that everyone was doing. I would like explain to him in front of my husband the abuse, and it was like it didn't matter that was happening. In a way, he would just look at my husband and say, well, you're not going to do that anymore, right? We're not going to be doing that anymore. And I remember I was starting to get really frustrated that no one was listening to me, and no one, like, are you think I'm lying about this? Like, what? He's not denying it. And this guy, I finally said, okay, I want to reenact what he did to me last night to you. Can I reenact it to you? Okay, you know, I'm like, now sit down, because I'm 5 foot tall. My husband's 6'2". And, you know, he's twice my size.
Twice it's, your weight.
More than twice my weight. Sit down. And I like stood up and I started yelling at him and saying and grabbing him and saying the things, because it's what his abuse was, very sexual and very it's like a humiliation. And so I started kind of reenacting it to him, and he was just, and I don't know, partway through he's like, okay, like, so, like, and I'm like crying, and he's like, yeah, well, you know, he just like gets up to him and like, you know, you're not, you know, you can't do that anymore.
yeah, no, I'm not going to do that anymore.
So this counselor can't even handle a little reenactment, and yet no. He's telling you to continue on, press on
forward.
Didn't
say anything about me, about just continue on, and whatever, like, little things that he told us to do was just no different than if you weren't in an abusive relationship, you know? And so I remember leaving, and luckily he had a serious surgery he had to go to, and we got transferred to another therapist. And this new therapist was actually great. And it was a woman. And when I told her what this guy had done, she was appalled. And she immediately started...
You mean you told her what the last therapist had done?
She was appalled. And she said, this is really serious, way more serious than you even see. And we need to, like, get you safe. And so she started talking to me more, you know, as, like, this is serious. It was getting really bad at that time. I didn't know at the time that he was doing steroids. And he'd been told by a previous therapist we'd gone to lots of therapists, that he shouldn't even drink coffee. He shouldn't have any caffeine because he has he's so easily angered and has control issues that anything that could, you know, raise his blood pressure, he shouldn't have. But he was always drinking coffee. He was always, you know, that didn't stop him. I didn't know he was doing steroids. I didn't know he was also having affairs on me at this time. But because he was having affairs, several, one with a client, neighbor, and another with a 19-year-old girl.
How old was he at that time?
45, I think. 45.
Yeah.
Yuck. I know. I didn't know he was doing this. So when someone's doing this, especially someone like him, they have to justify and blame you. I mean, I was always at fault for everything anyway, but now, I mean, I have to be really bad. I have to be really bad. And he was so mean that I was happy when he didn't come home. I didn't want him to come home. When he told me he's staying in his friend's house or his friend's cabin or whatever he would lie to me about and tell me what he's doing all the time, he was gone a lot. I was okay with that because I could sleep. I could have some peace. I wasn't, like, being kept up and yelled at. And so, yeah, I wasn't the best wife. I wasn't, like, checking up on him. Like, you know, he would tell me that that's why. But anyway, he got scary. He got a lot scarier. And I was getting more, I was dwindling. We sold our house. We put up our house up for sale. We had decided to move to another neighborhood and live in a rental house that we had for a time being. And mind you, we had moved like 20 times when we were married because we would buy houses, renovate them, sell them, you know, high-end houses, lots of them. We were doing lots of other people's houses. I was working a ton, driving my kids across town to different schools every day. I mean, we were just so busy. I was definitely losing it. Okay, so what you'd asked me, who had told me to leave. So right before we moved, the house was sold 2 weeks before we were about to move. I found out about his affair. Now, so silly now, looking back on it, I should have left him for all the abuse years before. But having an affair is what hit me the hardest. And not just because the betrayal and the lying and, all, you know, realizing all this, that's hard for anyone. But the fact that all of his control and abuse was around sexuality and our specialness and keeping our marriage safe and this is why. And it was so tied up in all of that, that it was a much bigger betrayal to me in my mind with, I'm going through all of this for this special relationship we have, and that, you know, you would never look at anyone else ever. And I'm not allowed to even talk to a waiter hardly, let alone, like, I would never cheat on him, you know? So, oh my gosh, I lost it, and I was losing it mentally, emotionally. He denied that he was having an affair. It was just emotional affairs, what he claimed to me. I had gone to the bishop. I was talking to the bishop a lot at that time, and he was a good guy, and he was saying, he never came right out and said, you should leave him. but he was definitely like kind of pushing me towards that way of thinking. He called my new bishop because we were moving in 2 weeks. I'm sure he was like, oh, get these guys out of here. But, and the new bishop, it was great, a great guy. Still love him. I immediately started going to him. I mean, the bishops were a big part of this stuff because I was always told every time I call my mom and cry to her, it was like, have you talked to your bishop? Have you talked to your state president? Have you, you know, she put them up on a pedestal and that they were the ones that were there to protect me and just help me. And I really believed that. I just thought they're going to. So yes, I kind of started getting pushed in that direction. And then my new bishop kind of, he actually told me some things like, if you were my daughter, you would not be staying in this marriage. Kind of, he would talk to me like that. He was very sweet. And
didn't your family do an intervention at some point?
Okay, yeah. So things escalated at that time to where I almost died a couple times. I can't believe I didn't die. Being strangled, held down for a long time. Yeah.
Locked in closets.
Yeah. I went to see my family for some kind of event, and I had a black eye, and I was like 80 pounds. I mean, I was looked terrible. And they just looked at me and said, this has got to end. Like, tell us. Because I didn't, they knew part of it. I didn't tell them everything. And so the interesting thing about this is, so my family's kind of half and half in a way. You know, my parents this time are both Mormon. Some of my siblings are not. Two of my sisters, I'm very close to my sisters. One is LDS, one's not. My non-LDS sister, who's never been LDS since she was a little girl, she, as soon as she saw that black eye, she started making phone calls and doing research on what do you do if you have a sister that's being abused. You know, she found out what you need to do. So we had a big drama happen that my sister was there with me, and we ran out of the house, and I was going to dinner with my mom and everyone down in Provo, and so we went down to dinner, and the whole dinner was basically an intervention for me to talk to me about, get me to talk and to see the severity of this. And I knew it was severe, and I would call my bishop or text him and say, I need help to get out of this. I'm so scared. And I knew that he had all of our money. I knew that he would leave. I knew that he would abandon my kids. I told that therapist that I could make it 5 more years because then my kids will be graduated, and then if he abandons them, it won't be as hard. I thought I could make it for them at least. And of course I'm hurting them, and it's so stupid that I did that, but I finally said, okay, you guys, I will do what you want. I'll do what you tell me to do because I can't do this. I can't do this anymore, and I am going to die. And they literally like recorded me saying, okay, you say that again. They recorded it. You're going to listen to us, right? And yeah, took me to my dad's house and talked to him, and everybody just said, okay, you've got to listen to us, and we're not going to leave you alone. And my sister, instead of saying, let's go to the bishop, because she was not Mormon, she said, we're taking you to domestic violence center tomorrow morning. And, you know, she's researched and she knows what to do. So they took me there, and they were amazing there. But it was the first time that I had talked to, they have you talk to a social worker, and they have you talk to policemen. I know that I had 3 interviews, and they don't let you leave. And my family stayed there with me, my sisters, and if they wouldn't have stayed with me, I wouldn't have been able to stay.
Because the whole time I'm there, I'm like, I don't know if I can really do this. I don't know if I can really do this. I can't believe I'm telling these things to people. And the police officer, it was the first time someone said to me, do you realize that what he's doing to you is a felony? And I was like, no, I don't. And he said, these are felony actions. Like, he should be in jail. No one had ever said that to me. None of these counselors or bishops, not my parents. Nobody knew. No one had been abused in my family like this. And that hit me pretty hard, just knowing that. I don't know. I was like, really? Like, this is really wrong. Like, how stupid that I would think that. So they took turns and they slept at my house, and he would text them incessantly. He's incessant text. He would start. We served him the protective order that day so that he couldn't come to the house. And I was so scared. I was so scared. And I knew that it was going to be bad. And I didn't know if it would be. I was afraid it'd be worse than being with them. And it was for a while. It was. One thing I remember him telling me when I was going through with this. He stood in the driveway, and he was crying to me and begging me to not do this, not to divorce him and not to report him and get the protective order. And he cried, and he said, we've only been together for 7 years. 7 years in eternity is nothing. We're supposed to be together. I know I'm supposed to be with you. And he would say everything I wanted to hear, because I wanted to hear that. I wanted him to love me like that. And I questioned myself. I mean, if it weren't for having the protective order where he couldn't text me anymore and he couldn't come near me, he couldn't call me, and my family staying there with me for quite a while, I wouldn't have made it. I got very physically ill. He immediately canceled our health insurance, bought himself insurance at the same time, but canceled all of ours.
Including the kids.
Mm-hmm. I remember being at the domestic violence center, and they gave me all these papers to fill out, and they were like food stamp papers and Medicaid and like all these like things, like to get money. And I was like, we have money, I'm gonna be fine, like I don't need all this. And they were like, oh honey, well, we'll just fill it out and then you can call us if there's a problem. And they clearly knew what was gonna happen, but I just didn't think that was possible. I thought, well, we have records, bank records, like we have the money, and he can't just take it all. Well, he did. And yep, we had to go on food stamps and Medicaid and get help from other people, because he took it all. And he didn't even text my children once. He didn't have anything to do with them. Not for their birthdays, not for Christmas. And I put them through this. Sorry. So I immediately started hating church. And I started thinking, none of these men have priesthood power. Nobody is talking to God. I don't believe it. I don't believe it anymore. And I would still go to church. I'd drop off my kids and pretend, and I'd leave. And I was... Oh my gosh, I was a primary teacher, and I would teach my primary class, and that was, and then I would leave, and it was just so hard to be there. because it represented everything I'd been fighting to have. And it just blew up in front of me. But I never even had it in the first place, let's just be honest. But I thought I wanted it.
This is a hard story. It's a hard story for me.
Yeah. Sorry.
So we'll talk about some good things now.
Okay. Well, met Mark. And I immediately knew we were going to be best friends forever. I'm like, he's going to be my best friend. I had no intention of ever getting married again. I had no intention of being in love again. I just decided that's just not for me, you know. But I wanted to date and make out and have fun. So I started drinking sometimes, numbing by myself mostly in the beginning. It was probably about, I want to say, 8 months or so after that protective order that I wanted to get divorced right away, but that was clearly not going to happen really fast. So I was like, I'm going to date, you know, I'm going to date. I had some friends from high school, like, that were, you know, single and inviting me out to do things. And I made a bunch of really great friends and I started dating. And I immediately was like, I'm just the fun girl because I'm not going to ever get married now, be in love again. But Mark and I were actually technically in the same ward at the time, because he had moved into the ward. His daughter and my daughter were good friends, and he had invited her to go on a trip. And I had knew from some friends that you were gotten separated and were living in the ward. And so I called you to just talk to you about the trip that you were taking my daughter on. And so we talked, and you had known about me being divorced, and so we just started kind of talking about it, being separated and how hard it is, and, you know, and you and I had was ahead of you in the game, so you'd ask me a lot of questions about how it is to be single and how it is to date. And anyway, we talked a lot about our exes. There was a lot of similarities. He didn't have the same kind of physical abuse and stuff, but similar mental stuff. And what? Maybe you should tell a little bit. You should talk. This is about us now.
Well, I had been told by a friend who lived in the ward that there was this really cute girl that I should get to know. And at the time, I was going fairly recently separated and was trying to figure out my life in a lot of different ways. It was after 18 years of marriage for me. And so we talked on the phone. I remember before I took the girls and my other kids on a trip, I took 5 kids by myself to Palm Springs for a week and had a great time. And Jessica's daughter, Carson, is the sweetest girl you've ever met. And I remember being on the trip thinking, man, if her mom is anything like the daughter, I need to get to know this girl. And so when I got back, I called you and we went to dinner. We went on some dates and had a lot of fun. You were the fun girl, and I'd never been on a date in 18 years. And I was trying to figure it all out. And I don't particularly want to get into all the details, but after we dated for a few weeks, not very long, one thing led to another, and Jessica got pregnant. I had 4 kids. You had 3 kids. And meanwhile, when we, before you found out, I left for 3 weeks to Africa on a safari.
And to pick up his parents from their third mission.
Talk about crappy timing.
So, yeah, the timing was bad all around because we were both just separated. We both had crazy situations we were dealing with, and
Both technically not divorced.
Not divorced.
I mean, we had nothing to do with our divorces.
We hadn't met until we were separated, yeah. But we were technically married at the time, and as we're reminded periodically. But we...
The state president at the time of this drama with my ex was his brother-in-law, who had then left to go on a mission, luckily, so they weren't around.
He's a good guy, and he was helpful. Yeah. So I'm in Africa, and when you're on a safari, there's not any cell phone coverage. So
no, we were emailing, but...
But, yeah, periodically when I would get in within range, we would email each other, and...
I don't think you can make this story any more complicated.
Oh, my gosh. No, literally,
we're not done yet.
He had gone... Like, he was only gone, 2 days, and I found out I was pregnant. And I probably cried, every day for the next several weeks. And, what am I going to do?
We hardly knew each other. I mean, we knew each other kind of, but it was very early in our relationship. Oh. And I was gone. I was long gone. And you found out, and you said, I have big news. I remember you did tell me that. You said, I have some big news for you when you get back. And I thought, whatever.
I didn't want to ruin his trip.
Yeah, she was nice not to try to... She tried not to ruin my trip. So I got home, and... picking up my parents from their mission, she told me. And it blew my mind on multiple levels. And so we don't need to get into all the detail. I mean, we went through a period of time where we tried to keep it secret because we knew...
From the kids.
Yeah. And our kids all went to the same high school. We knew it would be embarrassing for them.
We have four teenagers in the same high school. You know, kids, all of those things we taught you not to do, we've done them all.
Yeah.
Oops.
And so in November 2011, was it 20? I can't remember what year it would have been. 2012. November of 2012. Yeah. No, 2011 I think it was. Anyway, we got married. And we took a while. We didn't get married immediately. We wanted to make sure that we were...
We said, we need to date for a while and see if we like each other. And
so Jessica was pregnant.
How far along were you when you got married?
Oh, eight months. So we...
So the secret was out by then.
Oh, for sure. Oh, yeah.
The secret got out. That's a whole another story. And it caused a lot of drama with our kids and our families.
It didn't come out the way we wanted it to.
Yeah.
Because other people decided to gossip.
It was. Mm. It came out. Our my ex-wife learned through gossip, not from me. So we got married in November. The baby was born in January, and we have the sweetest little 2-year-old. She's the light of our life. I mean, we have these kids, and it brings everyone together, and it's been really great. But we hadn't been married very long, and. We had just gotten Jessica home from the hospital, and I had finally decided I needed to go back to work because I hadn't been to work very much because of the baby, getting the baby birth. And Jessica called me one day, about 10 days after the baby was born, and said, come home right now. So we rushed home, and she had... fainted and passed out on the floor and was throwing up, and we didn't know what was wrong, and we called the OBGYN to see if this was some complication, like an infection, and he thought it might be, so he told us to take her immediately to the hospital, which I did. We didn't call an ambulance, but...
So, I'm sorry, is this the baby that was sick?
No, it was me.
I was Jessica. Okay.
The baby was fine.
Okay.
Jessica was sick, and... after about 24 hours in the hospital, we learned that she'd had a massive stroke. So, here I am, newly married, with a 10-day-old infant, and a wife that I thought would probably die. And 8 children to support. That was a hard time. But she's here, and she recovered. We spent a lot of time in the ICU here in Salt Lake, and Jessica has recovered amazingly well.
I would never have known. Yeah, that's amazing.
It was not a normal kind of stroke, because my stroke was actually from an injury in my neck. I'm wondering how I got that. It was an injury in my neck, and probably wouldn't have had a stroke if I hadn't had a baby, but you're more likely to clot. So the injury started causing clotting.
But it's in the
back of my head, where, like, if you have a typical stroke's right or left side, so you have, like, impairments right or left. So the impairments that I had weren't the normal, which is why it took so long to figure out what's wrong with me, even.
She had actually about 20 to 25 strokes, little blood clots hitting her brain for as long, and we don't know how long that was taking place. It could have been days. So it was pretty serious, and but she recovered, and we brought her home. And I have to say, the ward was great.
You know, backing up, though,
yeah,
because we
should probably back up.
So
just a little bit.
I'm pregnant. I'm the knocked up chick in the neighborhood, and Mormon Inquirer, you know, we would go on our walks at night, and we would seriously kind of just laugh to get through it. It was just like, not, life could not be crazier, but we got along so well, and we had so much fun talking. And
every night we'd go for a walk for an hour and a half, and so we talked and talked and talked.
So he started, you made a few comments about that you were having some doctrinal issues with the church, and I was like, what? Doctrinal issues? Like, I had issues with the church just because of what I told you about the priesthood, and I didn't like going.
Had you stopped going at this point?
No, we were going. We were going. Like I said, I would go and sometimes leave. I was, you know, I didn't like it. I felt really uncomfortable there. I felt really just emotional. I do have PTSD from all this stuff that happened, and so I would get flashbacks and panic attacks and, you know, leave, and I wasn't happy there, but I felt so guilty that I hated it. Thought that I'm a bad person, that I don't like this. But you had left out on his iPad an interview with the McClays.
The Mormon Stories McClays. Interview of the McClays. And it was a video.
And I'm like, what is he looking at all the time on that iPad? What's he doing? You know, so I looked at it, and so I listened to it.
This was fairly early on in our relationship.
This was just right after we moved in together.
Yeah.
So I hadn't had the baby yet, but I was like, what the heck? Like, that shocked me. I had never questioned or doctrine or any thought that it just blew me away, like all this information. And so I immediately started listening to every podcast I could get a hold of. Like, you hear everyone say, you know, like, turn on the light switch.
And hours and hours.
When I came across Joseph Smith and the wives' stories, it was like listening to my ex. Like, he is my, just Emma, and like all the stuff she went through. And it was just like, I had no idea. I had no idea. And like what a lot of people say, where you just, I mean, I was very emotional and cried a lot and tried to call my sister and my mom and talk to people and get them to hear me, and they were just mad and like, why are you saying this? It was very hard, but it was a relief. Like, it was kind of like a relief. After I got through the emotional part and crying, it was a relief. And we both were just...
We went through it together. We studied, we read books, we've been doing it for 2 years. We had just moved into a new ward, and the people were so great. And I just have to be really clear that when we went through the stroke and the baby, the Relief Society was amazing. Yeah. And we would have all starved to death if it hadn't been for them. Jessica, after she got home, was on bed rest for quite some time, and they were so fantastic.
Yeah.
And one of the hardest things for me was, we went to church a few times, and I just knew, though, I couldn't do it anymore. And
yeah.
I couldn't go. I couldn't keep my mouth shut. I have a lot of history in the church. I'm a descendant of George Buchanan, and have taught gospel doctrine in many wards. And I've been in bishoprics and elders' quorum presidencies. And for me, this was a different process than Jessica. Mm-hmm. It wasn't much of a relief for me. It was an anger issue, but at the same time, I felt a lot of guilt because the ward was so wonderful to us, and I felt like I was letting them down. I did. I still feel that way when I see them and they wave and I wave back. And I do feel like I feel bad about that, but we just couldn't do it, neither one of us. And we went to church two or three times in that ward and never went back. So no one really knows us much in our new neighborhood, but that's okay. We have each other.
And nobody's tried to find out, really.
No.
Actually.
No one, no. The bishop a little bit, but he didn't really want to talk about the details, so it's okay. He doesn't need to. None of us are anxious to make a big splash or a big exit story. It's just better for us not to be in the church. And I don't know. I mean, we're kind of winding down. I just want to say that Jessica, I wanted her to tell her story because she has an amazing story. She's the... You, my love, you're the strongest person I've ever met. You are. You went through a lot. And you're tough. And you're amazing. And I'm the luckiest guy ever. I really am. And I love you. Thank you for getting knocked up and becoming part of my life. It's the best thing that's ever happened to me. It really is.
Well, like my mom said when I told her I was knocked up. She said, God picked this one. Because you suck at it. They really liked him. And
of course, now they blame me for taking her out of the church. So
I don't know that that's true, but they love you, and I do too. And you're the best man that's ever been in my life. I'm so lucky. So it's hard to explain. It's so confusing from our upbringings that, you know, getting knocked up at 40 in this kind of situation was the best thing that ever happened to us. It was the best thing.
Super lucky. And we've both never been happier. Never. And
we
did everything wrong.
We have a marriage that, not that's perfect, or... And there's all this drama that's happened, you know, with our exes are so hard and lawsuits with them and trying to get any money and kids and teenagers and we don't fight. We don't fight. And coming from so much fighting, both of us, because, you know, he hasn't told his story, but so much fighting on both ends. And we don't fight. I might sometimes say, I'm in a bad mood today, stay away from me. but he's amazing, and I'm lucky, and I love you too. Thank you.
Thank you, sweetie.
Well, anything I can say now is just a downer to the end of this podcast, because it couldn't have ended on a better note. I just wish that everyone could see what I'm seeing. The eye contact the two of them have together speaks volumes, and you are a survivor, and I'm grateful I got to listen to your story and see Thanks. How happy you can be when you have that release, when you let it go. So thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thank you, Katrine.
And come visit us at MormonExpression.com, and we'd love to hear your thoughts. And everyone have a good day. Bye.